Great. So it's my pleasure now to introduce Cliff Lynch. Cliff has had his hands and feet dirty in digital library developments his entire professional life. He's a bi-coastal person now. He lives out this way, but he works all over the place, and CNI essentially has its headquarters in D.C. Cliff runs the CNI as a meeting place. He's a brilliant and always up-to-date commentator on what's happening. And I am really delighted to see Cliff in front of us. Cliff, thanks a lot. Come on up here and tell us what you want us to think about. Thanks.
Thank you for that, Mike. Can people hear okay? Great. It really is a pleasure to be here, and it's nice to see a meeting dealing with preservation issues that seems to be sort of seriously action-oriented and seriously focused around some of the technology. There's a lot of theory that's been extended in this area, but turning from theory to practice seems to be a particularly hard transition and one that I think demands lots of attention. I thought what I would do in my 20 minutes or so this morning is just talk about a couple of what I see as the key emerging issues here. This is kind of a funny mixture, as so many things around preservation, of fundamentally technological issues, fundamentally economic or organizational issues, and issues that are really social or policy in nature. This is one of these areas where all three of those perspectives comes together in this sort of kaleidoscopic way. And the place I want to start is with storage. There's a big focus on storage here, as I think is appropriate. We're recognizing that, particularly in the short term, storage is a very significant cost of building any kind of set of infrastructure services that can support preservation. What's striking to me is that we are still, I think, very much evolving our ideas about what a storage substrate for preservation needs to be, and indeed what a storage substrate for a lot of other things in terms of IT needs to be. You know, it used to be when you talked to people about storage, they were obsessed about things like disk head crashes or media corruption or things like that. It was all a very local kind of a matter. And I think that now we've recognized that good storage systems are systems that not only protect against point failures, but in the sense of hardware kinds of point failures, but in fact are geographically distributed. They protect against various kinds of natural disasters simply through geographic distribution and replication. Yet, we have certainly no rigorous sense of how much distribution is enough. We have no rigorous sense of how to spread around that distribution in terms of its overlaying on various kinds of not only physical but geopolitical boundaries. Indeed, one of the really interesting ironies I've heard as companies look at some of these sort of cloud storage solutions is that some of them can't use them without guarantees about how the cloud overlays on various political boundaries, because certain kinds of sensitive data can't sort of casually cross boundaries, and apparently simply encrypting it isn't good enough under some kinds of legislation and policies around that. So I think we have some very, very interesting questions about how to build up storage services and what the right models are there. And this is one of these areas where there's a tremendous amount of investment and development that's going on that is not predominantly driven by preservation, but simply by the need for scalable, survivable information technology services to support the day-to-day operations of organizations. I just throw out one other kind of question about clouds and storage clouds and storage services, and that's one of service levels. I've actually talked with a number of people who've looked at things like Amazon S3 and started to ask the question about how could that fit in with a preservation strategy. And they've struggled with the notion that basically what Amazon says there is that we promise to, you know, kind of treat your data good and responsibly, and we're not going to parameterize that. And by the way, our lawyers said to tell you that you might lose it all tomorrow, and don't yell at us. And it's really hard to figure out how to take something like that, which comes with a kind of a legal and business definition like the one I gave you, but a pragmatic observational set of behaviors that suggest it's pretty robust, and say, how do we engineer this into a preservation system that we'd like to have certain kinds of engineering properties in terms of robustness, reliability, vulnerability to failure. So the whole question of how we think about or whether we're just going to give up on service level agreements in an age of cloud computing services, or whether we're going to see another generation of cloud computing services that come with these service level agreements, I think is a very germane kind of a question. So I think there's lots to think about in these areas. Clearly, one connection which needs to be underscored occasionally is that cloud storage is useless without very high bandwidth connectivity to the cloud. And that's something that maybe isn't an overwhelming issue for our major research libraries that are embedded in great universities, at least in the United States. Most of our major universities have pretty good network connectivity, but as we start thinking about scaling this kind of thing out and using this technology more broadly, it is worth remembering that there is that kind of implicit connection between storage and network bandwidth. Now, let me turn to a couple of other issues that start getting a little bit more political, a little bit more policy-oriented. One of the, great emphases that I think our community has taken in terms of preservation so far is to working with content producers, working with publishers, working at scale. Think about projects like Lox or Portico, which try and engage publishers that are producing very large amounts of material, or thinking about strategies for how do we deal with federal government information, for example. How do we deal with very large collections of sound recordings or video? What do we do about archiving the news? Now, these are hard problems. You all know how hard they are. But at the same time, there are some elements of them that are easy or at least trackable. For example, when you talk to scholarly publishers about the importance of having a preservation strategy, this isn't really that hard to sell in the abstract. They recognize that they're not going to have authors if they can't tell some kind of a credible story about preservation. Yet, if you look at the intellectual history of our society. If you look at the sort of signature thing that makes some of our great research collections great, it's that they not only collected at scale, but they also managed to acquire and preserve the personal and organizational papers of key figures, key thinkers, artists, political figures, intellectuals, scientists. Those things are a critical part of the collections that we need to take forward. And understanding what happens with those kind of personal collections is very tied up, I think, in changes in personal behavior as more and more of your life moves to the network. We've already got a few important projects that are starting to explore elements of this. I point you, for example, at the very interesting Digital Lives effort that is being funded in the UK based at the British Library, where they're trying to deal with the intake of personal collections that include a lot of digital material from political figures primarily. There's lots of kind of ad hoc projects going on around the states. But this is an enormous problem that's going to show up at scale. And I would suggest that people are starting to have some very strange relationships with the digital record of their lives that's going to get complicated here. For example, we are seeing the rise of various kinds of forensic tools that will fish out all kinds of bits of your digital history that you thought went away. We are starting to see the application of these forensic tools on a, at least kind of random basis, at borders and other kinds of places. All of a sudden, there is some evidence that people are becoming very uncomfortable about how much of their lives are kind of uncontrollably wrapped up in their computers. And I think that this may have some particularly troublesome implications as we start thinking about what happens when we start acquiring this material or wanting to acquire it as part of a collective social and intellectual history. There's some very interesting discussions starting to happen in the special collections world about things like the ethics of special collections. And all of a sudden you can ask just bizarre questions. Is it ethical to acquire a special collection from someone that includes, let's say, a collection of obsolete laptops, and then turn loose your graduate students with forensic tools to see what they can resurrect from the unerased free space in there? Is that really a good way to build relationships with your donors? I don't know. Certainly there is some history that says that biographers know, you know, no limits of decency. We need to talk about these things. We also have a set of interesting phenomena where more and more of your digital life is not on your laptop. It's out there on Flickr. It's out there in various kinds of social networking. It's out there in your Amazon purchase history. It's out there in the blog you keep. And interestingly enough, while I think most of the people in this room recognize that something like Flickr is a sharing service and not a preservation service, these two roles are, you know, profoundly confused in the mind of the general public, which absolutely believes these things are preservation services and therefore may not be keeping local copies of material that they have uploaded to these sites. So you have a whole set of questions about how do you kind of reacquire the trails of a person to assemble the analog of their papers. I think these are really pretty critical questions, and they're the sort of hard, one, you know, isolated problem at a time issues that we face if we're really going to take a comprehensive view towards preserving intellectual and social history in the digital world. Let me turn to just a couple of other things that I want to talk about very briefly. One is the question of intellectual property law versus preservation. And really, that's almost too narrow a way to frame it. What we've seen, if you kind of look at the great sweep of legislation, and not just legislation, but a lot of the sort of social and economic practice around it, is the propertization of a whole lot of material. This is very much at odds at some level with our ability to preserve it, because preserving is about saying this matters to society and that society has a stake in it. We're seeing a little bit of light shed on this, I think. For example, I'd point you in the US at the debates about the revision of Section 108, but I still feel like this fundamental intellectual tension has not been adequately framed for public debate. I think this is going to become particularly important in the coming years. I was intrigued to see recently that there's going to be a meeting in July that is going to be hosted at the World Intellectual Property Organization that the Library of Congress apparently has had a hand in through its NDIP program to talk a little bit about some of these tensions. I guess I would say I'm not expecting too much from that meeting, but I think that framing this question in the right way is terrifically important. And it has to go beyond the sort of fine legalities of copyright. Second of the last three policy points I want to touch on. We talk a lot about preservation. And I think that one of the things that's very healthy that is happening now is that we're starting to hear a stronger conversation about reuse. In other words, it's not just kind of preservation in the abstract is a good thing, but you preserve it to facilitate its reuse, to facilitate building upon it. If you look at things like the NSF cyber infrastructure programs, investments in data curation, and particularly DataNet, the talk there is very much about reuse rather than preservation in the abstract. And I think that is a very important kind of guiding light to consider as we try and think about the right ways to do preservation. I'd also say, in conjunction with that, that there is a growing realization that computation is going to be very tied up with access and reuse. You know, it's very easy to follow the sort of old models of physical archives, to think about we're going to save all this stuff, and the usage model is that some human being wanders in and says, I'd like this box of material and I'm going to spend a week looking through it. What we're actually, I think, going to see with these enormous digital archives that we're developing is we're going to see researchers say, I want to unleash this enormous computationally intensive process on this entire digital archive as a way of refining something out of it for reuse of the material. That's a terrifically different kind of a model, and I think that that's finally getting at least a little bit of attention in how we think about structuring our archives and thinking about how we structure our access services to them. The last thing I want to comment on is this wonderful phrase, sustainability, otherwise known as who pays. Otherwise known as, hopefully somebody else pays, because I don't want to. I think that we're seeing at least a little bit of engagement on this. Certainly sustainability figures prominently in most discussions of digital archiving. Unfortunately, I think that we're sort of not coping with this terribly well. There is, you know, one approach that says, let's put out off all the hard questions for a while and argue instead about what does it cost rather than who pays. The fact of the matter is we know it's going to cost substantially and someone's going to have to pay for it. So getting sidetracked entirely into that discussion I don't think is helpful. There are people who seem to suggest that there's some kind of magic we can do if we just get enough economists involved, that somehow they'll create resources out of nothing. And you know, my experience with economists is that they can be very clever people and they can be very good at moving resources around and aggregating them, but they aren't the tooth fairy. I think that we are coming round finally to some serious discussions about who's going to pay for this. And I think that probably the next step in here is going to be some actual recognition that it is squarely within the mission of certain kinds of organizations like research libraries and universities and parts of government and other entities to actually deal with this preservation in the long term. That seems to be a very hard statement to make. I take a certain amount of comfort, I guess. Well, comfort is too strong. I have been pleased to see the debate that has emerged in the last year about the role of universities, particularly as publishers or disseminators of information. I think that that is a very healthy discussion to have. But I think that the other side of that discussion is the role of universities as stewards of information and stewards of the intellectual record and the evidence that supports it. I think that that is a fundamental policy discussion which is just starting to bubble up and is going to be, I think, absolutely essential to sorting out what needs to happen in terms of truly sustainable economic and organizational structures to deal with digital preservation. So those are a few of the developments that are very much on my mind as I follow what's going on. I hope that at least some of them resonate with things that you're seeing, or maybe at best even help you to make sense or see in a different way how some of the developments that I think we're all watching interconnect. Thanks.